8:54 near Rush, Kentucky, talking to J.P. Fraley. And I'm going to go through a series of questions, and you can respond to them. We want it to be informal. If you think of something else you want to add and tell me about some other project or place you've been or whatever, the purpose of this is to create some record and some insights for those people who have been so unfortunate as to not ever got to hear any good old-time fiddle music or traditional music. So, how much time do you spend working at your music now? Do you play it every day, or do you keep it in the case and just get it out when you're going to play on stage?
I keep it in the case. Right now, I just got back in North Carolina, down there, if you can imagine it, playing in competition. I hadn't practiced, and you can still see the blisters on my wrist. I don't play that often. The fiddle is, I suppose, part of me, and is my hobby. I mean, one of my hobbies. I couldn't say that it was my main hobby, and I couldn't say it was my lesser hobby. With fiddling and fishing and gardening, they're just about in the same categories.
You have one of the most beautiful gardens I have ever seen. You've got head lettuce out there. Did you grow that from seed?
No, I didn't grow it from seed. I got some plants right after Christmas. That's what I say. No, I'm joking you. And the people, they asked me, said, J.P., said, are you going to put them in your garden? I said, yes. They said, are you going to cover them? I said, yeah, I'll put some dirt around them. And anyway, I was showing the fella here some of the head lettuce. I mean, it's really great. I mean, for this time of year, especially. Now what you want to know about the rest of the garden?
I want to know how you do the broccoli. My broccoli looks pitiful.
Well, I put it in the ground. I read an organic gardener where a lady sang hymns to her tomatoes to get them to ripen early. I'm dead serious. I showed it to Anna Dean, and I figured that I could get broccoli come along pretty well with fiddle tunes. I don't really go out in the garden. I'm afraid they'll come and get me in a little white coat, but I open the door and play loud.
Broccoli breakdown. I want to hear that tune.
Broccoli breakdown.
What prompts you to learn a new tune?
I don't really know. If I like the tune, I'll take the time to learn it. If it is a prominent fiddler in one of his specialties, I think it's a good word for it. One of his tunes, I guess we would say. I might learn it, but I would never play it in public. I mean, as a tribute to that individual. I know because he'll play some of the tunes that I play, which all fiddlers, you know, they got a pattern of tunes. Everybody knows Cripple Creek, Sally Gooden, Old Joe Clark, and tunes of this order, so they're normal, I mean, to play. But if a fiddler has a specialty, I don't bother to play it, at least as long as he's living. But if he dies, I'll play that fiddle.
Then it's your turn. You get in, jump in there and claim that tune.
Yeah, but
play it soon after, and then it's yours.
Yeah, I say, I learned this from so-and-so, and it's pretty well the way it is.
Would you name over some of the tunes that you learned to play as a child? I know you learned at a very, very young age. Would you name some of those? And
well, I mean, about all that I do. Bill in the Low Ground, the Forked Deer, Cripple Creek, Sally Gooden, Bill Cheatham, Turkey in the Straw, Arkansas Traveler. I mean, just about the whole repertoire of fiddle tunes that I learned when I was a kid. I learned a lot from Daddy, and I learned a lot from other fiddlers. And the styles of fiddling, what I like, I think I mentioned to you before about a fiddler. When a fiddler plays the way he feels the tune, 'tis better. And if I hear it one time and I get that fiddler's style, I don't have to see him. I mean, if it's 10 years later, I say, hey, I know who that is playing the fiddle. That is, to me, is fiddling. And really and truly, I might have mentioned this to you too. We have too much of this thing today. It's no big challenge for a person when they learn to play a fiddle to copy mm-hmm. another fiddler. And when you copy another fiddler, that's like doing a John Denver song, trying to imitate him, or sing like Johnny Cash, or a stutter like Mel Tillis. And it takes away. I mean, you're only an imitator. So you learn the tune, you play it the way you feel, and a lot of times with a fiddler, you can almost tell if he's depressed, if he's happy, or what's going on, just simply by the way he plays the fiddle. I mean, at the particular time, although you heard him before. Now what?
What would cause you to quit playing the fiddle?
Oh, God. I guess to be paralyzed or... I don't think anything could stop it, because music is a part of a person. It's some people say, "Hey, say I can't learn music." That I kind of doubt. Maybe they didn't have occasion to learn or try to learn. And I always use this thing. Did you ever see a robin that couldn't sing? Mm-hmm. Same thing with music.
How do you go about deciding what tune you're going to play where? Say, for instance, you're at North Carolina.
Oh,
how
yeah.
do you go about deciding which tune you're going to play for what occasion?
Takes about 6 hours. Me and Annadine fights, and I cuss a little bit. And she says, "Well, you're making a mistake. Don't play that tune." And this goes on. Eventually, we go on stage. And I think, really, we might... I mean, occasionally know what we're going to play, but usually we walk on stage and I say, "Hey, we're going to play this," and that's the way it is.
So sometimes you just surprise
yeah,
them.
Well,
you like that suspense
of
wondering.
No, because we're kind of used to it. I think really the whole essence of it, that Annadine and I are not really uptight about competition.
Mm-hmm.
I could care less about it. As the old saying goes, you win a few and you lose a few. Everybody likes to win, but there can only be one winner. But I just like to play. And if we do well, we do well. If we don't, we don't.
Where did you first play in a public setting?
Oh, probably at school. I mean...
Where was your school?
Ed Hitchens. In Carter County, in a grade school. And possibly it was with Mark Dixon, his long dad was a banjo picker. That was when a band consisted of a fiddle and a banjo. And he would carry me through the woods to play for pie suppers or whatever, cakewalks, whatever was going on. And I figure maybe that in public that I played with him first. I'd say I did.
What was the school like where you went to?
It was a 1 and 2 room schools, country schools. Of course, the people didn't have a lot of money, and we would play for nothing or whatever was going on. Sometimes they'd charge a dime to get in. But they'd have to pay for this and pay for that, and they'd pay us a little. Sometimes we'd have to pay them a little. I mean, it was just a lot of fun. I mean, it wasn't no big thing. I mean, about the finances of the situation.
Have you played continuously since you learned how?
Well, at intervals, I suppose. A lot of people think that I play all the time.
Sounds like you do.
No, I don't. Fact of the matter, people, I said, "Well, look," I said, "I haven't played." They said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "I work in the mines." Working? Well, you shouldn't work in the mines. I mean, they start right away. But they don't relate to that situation. I think I mentioned to you a distinct pattern with a fiddler to me is a worker, a person that is in the mainstream, He's one of the guys that was mighty inspired song that, like, the girls all get prettier at closing time, you know. I mean, it figures. I mean, that is that person's life. That is part of him. And the same thing with a fiddler. A fiddler is a worker to me. Now, there's a professional fiddler. He does it for a living. He might have to, because he probably couldn't enter the mainstream as a worker. But could you imagine General Garfield playing the fiddle? He was a fiddler, and a very good one. Our earliest rendition of The Blackberry Blossom was his favorite fiddle tune. And you couldn't imagine him sitting down his musket and take time to play the Blackberry Blossom. But that to me is a fiddler. Was Andrew Jackson played the fiddle. You've heard the song, they'll hang Jeff Davis on the sour apple tree.
No, are you going to sing it for me?
No, but it is a march, and Jefferson Davis played the fiddle. But they didn't do it professionally, no doubt, because they was famous people. And here, I'll never be famous. Maybe I'll get on welfare eventually, but that'll be about it.
Has being a fiddle player ever created some problems for you?
Oh, yeah, it will with marriage, with your mother and with your father, because you'll ask your mother where you are. And he's the very one that instigated me to play the fiddle. And when I got to playing for square dances, you know, he'd always ask mother where, and she said, don't worry about him, said he'll be in after a while. And sometimes it was after a while, it was like day after tomorrow when I get back. But no, all in all, the fiddle, to me, has opened a lot of doors. Otherwise, I couldn't have gotten in. When I grew up, of course, the radio was a big thing, you know, and the Grand Ole Opry. And, of course, we lived with the phonograph, with the records of the Skillet Lickers and all those people. The fiddle kind of got satirized as a moonshining and a drinking. Well, the Baptist called a fiddle the devil box, and you couldn't play it in church unless the organ was broke down. I don't know, you know, anything about that or not. But when her pump organ would break, you know, if there was a fiddler around, which kind of happened to me occasionally, they would let the fiddler come in and play hymns, you know, while they sang in church. But as soon as they got the pump organ fixed, the fiddler wasn't allowed in there no more. And you was daresome to start swinging the old rugged cross or something, because that was the end of it.
If you had to identify any force that's kept you interested in fiddling, what would it be?
Marielle, I don't know. I think with anybody that plays, once they start to play, it becomes a part of them. Where they make progress, or where they reach a certain level or a plateau and they stay there, that is part of that individual. After I started learning, about 9 years old, and listening to very good fiddlers that just, I don't know, by fate or whatever you want to call it, happened to be in the area where I was. And then later, I mean, with friends and stuff that we played, that music was as much a part of us as anything in our old makeup.
Was the radio programs, I know you played for the radio station on a weekly basis at one time.
Yeah.
Was that rewarding?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you liked that. Sometimes even when I couldn't be there. Maybe Anadine and MB, I'd be listening, you know, maybe be working, and I'd get a great kick out of this thing. I mean, that was part of us, and you know, it's nothing like people say, hey, say he plays on the radio, you know, he's a radio star. They paid weekly. They paid very weekly. I don't think they ever paid weekly.
Very weekly.
I never did.
You made enough to get you there and back.
No. I had to work hard. That's sometimes why I had to work Saturday so I could be there the next Saturday, you know, to get that overtime to get my way to the radio station. No. Mm-hmm. It was more just publicity. But we didn't know what we was doing. We just loved it. We didn't even think of it as, say, hey, they're down there doing so-and-so big publicity stunt, you know. No, it didn't occur to us.
It seems like every time I turn around, I see your name and Anna Dean's listed as being participants and performers in this festival, or I see you over here, and I know you've been all kinds of different places, probably more places than we can name. Mm-hmm. On all of the tapes here that you have the inclinations to want to detail here, but did you ever go through a period where you didn't play out, where you didn't perform in a more public thing?
I think Anna Dean and I both did. This is a strange thing. When we were young, we played. Like teenagers and so forth. But when Anna Dean and I got married, we didn't play. It was 14 years about that, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That I don't think we touched the string. We got, it's kind of interesting. We got busy. I was loading coal, breaking on the motor, working in the mines, and, trying to get ahead. It even took us forever to get a refrigerator. I never will forget it, boy. That was something. But we had two babies then. But lo and behold, a fella asked us if we would come to Leslie County, the county seat of Leslie County, at Hyden, and play in a talent show. Well, we went over. I don't know where we won that or not, but there were some people. It was the Wilburn brothers or Osborne brothers. Kids.
You mean the Osborne Bluegrass
group? The Osborne brothers. I said, boy, oh boy. No, listen, we won that thing.
They were from over there.
I said, them little fellas can play, you know. But we hadn't played in a long time. Well, that was the end of that. It was in conjunction with George Wooten, who later became a judge of Leslie County. Then we got back here. The mines got slow. The Korean War started. No, wait a minute. I come to Webville. The day the Korean War started, I went back to the brickyard to work making brick. We lived right here. And they was having a big fiddling contest at Flatwoods, Kentucky. If you made the first prize $100, my God, that was like $1,000, you know. And I had played there. I said, let's go down there and play in that fiddling contest. I said, we might win that money. She said, I don't have no guitar. Well, her guitar had come apart, and my fiddle wasn't too good a shape. I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll go see if I can find you a guitar. So I went into Zwick's Music Company in Tyson. Carl Reeves, he used to be my singing teacher. He kicked me out of singing school. I couldn't do too good. This is when, as a kid, I pinched one of the girls with my foot, you know, on the seat in front of me. And he said, that's the end of your singing career. So I went to playing. This is facts. He'll tell you today. And I couldn't sing too good, no how. But she looked good, you know. And I can't tell you the rest of it anyhow. That was the end of my singing career. So I went in to talk to Carl, and Carl said, JP, he said, I've got a trip along.
Oh,
we didn't get that, did
we? No, you're probably playing.
But anyway, Carl told me about this guitar that some fellow took out and paid a few payments on it, maybe a whole lot. But he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, listen. I said, we want to go down to Flatwood and play that fiddling contest. He do about it. And he said, JP, he said, I haven't heard you played. I said, buddy, they ain't either. I said, I ain't played in years. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, if you'll let me have that guitar, I said, if I win that contest, I said, I'll buy it. If I don't, you're going to get it back. He said, take it. Well, the first prize was
$100. He won
$109. Oh, he won $109. Then where that little old guitar wind up cost me $9. But the irony is the thing. There was Jim Wheeler, was a hornpipe fiddler, and he's still living down near Portsmouth. I mean, he is good. And there's a famous fiddler that's in Nashville today, Buddy Spiker. He was from Charleston, West Virginia. Buddy was trying to get enough money, if you can imagine this. What year was it, Annadine?
Must have been about 58 or 59.
Okay. He was trying to get enough money to go to Nashville. He had a job with John and Jack. But I didn't know it at the time. And anyway, we was playing this old fiddling contest. We wound up with me and Buddy Spiker had to play
the playoff.
Hal Murphy was the MC. I mean, it was something. Hal Murphy didn't know me mad. In fact, they thought I'd come out the backer patch somewhere, you know.
It was a applause meter, and we didn't know. Annadine
didn't have no strap for guitar. All she had was a pajama string, and that thing tied around there. I had a clothespin. I'm serious. I had a clothespin to hold my fiddle together, you know, pulling it back on. And Buddy, he tore up his fiddle bow. Oh, God, he played so pretty. I mean, I said, Annadine, I said, there ain't no way. I said, we don't even belong to this bunch of stuff, you know. And he tore up his fiddle bow. Nobody loaded his fiddle bow. And he had said, could I borrow your fiddle bow? I said, well, sure. I mean, that's something. He took that, Buddy. I mean, he really played rusty. I forget what he played. He played something that was, he totally, you know, you can overplay with the fiddle.
He played Flop-Eared You, and he did fine. Until he decided to speed it up.
Well, he played right over top of people's heads. And I don't remember what I played. I don't remember much of anything. But boy, I'll tell you, when that applause meter flipped up and I got that $100, I come home. Randall, you died laughing at me. I said, Annadine, I said, I'm going to play some ball, you know. And I was over here in this house. I pulled the one string. That clothespin flew off. He went to that car. I said, oh, my God. Oh, my. Now, you talk, oh yeah, but Buddy Spiker is one of the finest country violinists that I know. In fact, the matter, he arranges all of these real good fiddle things that comes out of Nashville on the records.
Well, you see,
he's a staff fiddler. I mean, he is a super fiddler. Well, a country violinist is what I said, Buddy. I told him one time, I said, the only thing I don't like about you fiddling, I said, you're just up there like a little machine, you know, you wind up. And that's the trouble, a lot of fiddlers. I mean, they don't show feeling. Buddy don't show feeling. But he is a super fiddler. You see him occasionally playing a hoedown with a beard, you know, with dancers on the Nashville thing. But what he was trying to do, he had some problems I won't even mention. He's a fine person. But he was trying to get to Nashville. And he did make it. And he straightened up his act. I mean, anything happens to him good, he deserves it because he tried.
You were talking a few minutes earlier about Clark Kissinger. I didn't know that you knew him.
Oh, a lot of people don't know. I knew Clark. Clark did quite of an understudy. As a fiddler, I guess, of Ed Haley. I liked him. Now, he had a personality with his fiddling, but he copied Ed Haley meticulously. And I don't know if you know it or not, a lot of fiddlers resented this fiddler or that fiddler. Clark, Ed Haley, resented Clark Kissinger playing his fiddle tunes all the time. But they played, they said the Kissinger brothers, they even made records.
Mm-hmm.
But they wasn't brothers, they were cousins. And they played at the brothels. on Summer Street in Charleston, West Virginia. And when I was a teenager breaking on motors on Coal River in West Virginia, every 2 weeks on payday, I'd go down to Charleston and I always make it a point to go down there and listen to those people. I don't want Andy to know to went around there to look at them girls. But they were there.
No. She wouldn't know that.
Like Russ Morgan, that's four of them. Russ always said, that's four of us married.
Right. That was back in that other life.
But
that was your first life.
they played good music at those places. Well, fact of the matter is the Nickelodeons, or the Honky Tonks we call them, they weren't very good quality at that time. And the darn things would break down and so forth. And about the only time the fiddlers and musicians got a rest when the honky tonk was playing, but they didn't work too good, you know. And somebody put in a quarter, you could get five records for a quarter, you know. You can't do that.
You can't do that now.
They didn't get no bonus. You didn't get like six records for a quarter. But sometimes they'd only play two, and you talk about somebody raising sand, so they'd have to unplug the honky tonk, and that fella said just have to keep playing. But Clark Kessler, well, he was a notable fiddler, a very good one. To me, much better than Natchez the Indian and those old people. They were classed as superb fiddlers, but they wasn't. Natchez the Indian was not a good fiddler. He was one heck of a good show person, because you take, it's like taking nothing from him. Doug Kershaw can play some pretty fiddle, but normally he's got the skin-tight breeches, you know, and the tight-fitting clothes, and him a-wiggling like a eel, a-playing fiddle, and he becomes a personality from that respect. Natchez the Indian was the same thing with the deerskin clothes, with the fringes, you know. I mean, whether he's playing well or not, it looked good. I mean,
where did you see Natchez the Indian playing?
Well, all around here. They was based in Huntington, Cowboy Copas, Hawkshaw Hawkins. Those people.
I'm going to ask you to comment on something. We didn't get Cherokee Shuffle from Natchez the Indian, did we? Where did we get Cherokee Shuffle anyway?
I don't know where that come from. Strange things happened, Mary Nell. We were playing at Square Dance down in Ohio. And here a fella come out there, a little short fella like myself, black hair, and played the guitar. Had a girl with him, and I said, well, I know that. And I got to talking to him, and I said, what's your name? He said, Billy Starr. Was Bill Stallard, the guitar picker for Natchez the Indian. How long ago has that been, Annity?
Must have been quite a while ago. Oh, you mean?
Billy Starr, Bill Stallard.
Are you talking about when we played Square Dances, when you did?
When we played. Down at, when I first started playing at Lewis Lake. Yeah.
You know, I vaguely remember.
Yeah.
Indian Bill in Little Montana. It was the way they built
Indian Bill.
What is the appeal around this tri-state area for the Indian and the Montana? Is it just something different?
Okay. Marinell, you kind of got to know a little bit. It's probably hard you associate the Indians, I mean, with this neck of the woods. But right at the forks of Tug River, Kanawha, the Ohio. But see, this was the bailiwick of the Indians. I mean, their homes, even down here when you start digging along the Eye River, you find all of the artifacts of the Indians. The serpent mounds is right across over here. Over in Ohio, just a little way here, there's Indian mounds.
There's Indian mounds in Central Park.
Yeah, right here in Ashland. But a lot of people don't know that. And what really disturbs me, when you start talking to people here, they are living in the one of the richest part of folklore from the Indians and the pioneers and right on, because well, even with myself, no older than I am, a lot of the fiddle, you know, I told you I learned from other people. My daddy run a park. In this park they had carnivals, circuses. And with these people come some of the finest musicians you'd ever know, because they couldn't make a living playing in the big cities. They was on the road. And also the hobos that come through, the loggers, the coal miners, iron workers, and they all played. That is what I was trying to get the emphasis on the thing. To me, a fiddler was a worker. I mean, he had something to do besides play the fiddle. And 9 times out of 10, the fiddle was his Saturday night thing, you know, his good timing situation. But we live in a place that all this happened because the timber was back up the Big Sandy. The coal was in West Virginia in Big Sandy. I don't remember the tugboats that went up Sandy, but you know, they took boats of clothing, you know, for women to make their dresses and stuff. They took a lot of cotton, things that, well, even implements, cookware and stuff. They'd bring back tobacco, molasses, with the tugboats and the pole boats. And I just kind of forced it. I mean, living in the last part of that situation, but it was right here. And a lot of people, they don't even want to take that part of their heritage in account. It's like that they're ashamed of it, but that was one of the richest and one of the best heritages that they'd ever have.
I hate to interrupt, but it's 7:15.
Okay. I mean, they're open in there till 9. Pick said he'd be in there.
Well,
then.
I didn't know if you were going to stay any length of time, if you were going to... time you get ready and then get in there, it won't...
See, now we're putting this on a document.
Well,
here.
That's okay.
She got cut off.
Okay. But you can go.
There's a person in North Carolina who really impressed me. He's wealthy. Him and his son or son-in-law was playing fiddle. Boy, it was hot. And I went up there and I listened to this fella. And really the quality of the fiddle, it was like maybe you'd hear somebody playing, maybe been playing 2, 3, maybe 5 years. But what he had into it, I mean, he was playing these notes and it was chill bumps on his arms while he played. And I got to playing fiddle with him later and got to know him pretty well. One of the finest people I ever met, his name was Newt Smeltzer. I said, Harper, I said, what does that feller do for a living? He said, J.P., said, he's a millionaire. I said, gee, that ain't crowded. Yes, he was. He was a millionaire. I mean, he made it before Harper took over as involved in this dairy co-op down there in North Carolina. And I said, Harper, I said, what's he doing over here playing the fiddle? He said, he just loves it. I mean, just, but you think, well, here's a guy that he could, if he'd just really put his mind to it, would have played all kinds of fiddle, but he was totally satisfied with what he was doing, with all these chill bumps. And I never felt that way. I mean, I feel what I play. But here's a guy, I mean, he was in another world playing the fiddle.
Harper Van Hoy works with dairy farmers. Is he a dairy farmer?
Well, he was one. Marionelle, what he told me, I forget what he told me he was, but he would go to Washington. He would lobby for the dairy farmers in North Carolina, and he still does. I mean,
well, he's a dairy farmer.
Yeah, he is a professional dairy farmer.
He has a herd,
yeah.
And he
milks. Oh yeah.
I worked with dairy farmers there in Amarillo, Texas. And
enough water to make a milk cow.
When I found out he was a dairy farmer, he has a big old house, the old home place there where they have the festival, and he just lets different ones stay in it, you know, and sleep there during the festival. Well, this one year, I don't know if he's left there or not, or he had invited us up for breakfast. I might have stayed there, my cousin and I, yeah. anyhow, when we had breakfast the next morning, well, they were, you know, fixing the eggs and baking everything. I said, well, I'll go out to the car. I had some Cremora or something out there, you know.
Cremora.
And he said, you don't ever bring that artificial stuff around dairy farmers.
I couldn't believe it.
I went at it. He said something. Said, why do you do so? And so said, I'll go out and get the Cremora. He didn't miss a lick. He fried eggs or something. He said, hey, today.
We don't use that stuff, North Carolina.
Well, he went out for a while, and he retired from it. And then I think in the last couple of years, he bought a herd and started back again.
He's gone back. He got
this past winter or something. We were talking about he'd lost a lot of weight. He said, oh, when you put up 90, I don't know if he...
90 tons.
Maybe it's
90
tons of silage, he said,
you
lose it.
Mary Nell, you know what went through my mind when he said that? Anadine well remembers, you know, I'm not very big. But when I worked in the mines, I worked underground. I say every day that I loaded coal is from 30 to 35 tons underground. And on one Saturday, there was three of us people. Is Bert Wooten and Ralph Campbell and myself, we loaded 350-ton guns by ourselves. And Philly Shepherd hauled all the coal out there, right there at Wooten. You know, when Wes wanted to get the three guns out on account of the marriage. And I look back at that, if somebody would tell me today to take a shovel and move 50 ton of coal, I said, buddy, you're crazy.
Eh? Yeah.
Even just a few tons.
I mean, that was a railroad dump of coal.
Boy.
Underground.
Now, where are these other fellows you mentioned?
They're dead.
Well. Well.
Yeah, Ralph and Bert. And I don't know where Felix Shepherd is. I sure don't.
Well, Felix, he got killed. Well.
Probably got killed.
Yeah, killed.
No, destroyed.
Somebody come out. No, he wasn't destroyed. He was just killed.
Well, he was hurt real bad. That was different.
Leslie County, I was going, you had to learn a different language. Come out one morning and said, well, old Felix got killed Saturday night.
Well, Arthur Corner got killed.
JP said,
I said, well, what time's the funeral? Oh, he ain't destroyed.
He ain't destroyed. He was just wounded.
My bad.
That's when I look back at that. He was there a year, and that's before tape recorders. I would have given anything had I gotten a lot of those conversations.
Not destroyed, just wounded.
That was wounded.
Seriously.
If somebody was a growing, they was a crowd.
You ever take the baby up there and this the lady kept saying, boy, he's a crowding. He sure is crowding. I didn't know what was wrong with the kid. Found out that she meant he was growing.
Have you got that all?
No, we saw it.
That was plunder was, things you don't want.
Stolen guns.
Yeah, stolen. Just furniture.
Huh.
That's what they call
it, furniture. Andy, which, is Leisure's on cart?
Central.
This person that died, to give you all an idea.
He's
the one that interviewed me 14 years ago when I hired him. And he said, JP, no, he didn't say JP, he said, Mr. Fraley, he said, I was 48 years old. He said, what are you doing out of work? No, he said, where did you work? I said, I worked at the brickyard over in Ironton. He said, well, what are you doing out of work? I said, the brickyard burned down. He said, I'll hire you. He said, damn it, he said, a brickyard don't burn down. He said, you'll pick right in.
I said, Andy, it wasn't you. I said, just hear a kind word. That was more than I could take right now. That's what I'm afraid I've gotten into with this last Friday. Jenny said that I can't do, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to respond to people's needs, that they will need things that I won't be able to deliver, or that they will be asking me questions that I don't know the answer to. I'm not the person, the buck doesn't stop on my desk, and...
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that I've done the right thing. I think you have some advantages in that you can abide with the rules of the state park, mm-hmm. and as long as you meet those rules, the rest of it yes. is yours to shape as, yeah. as much as you can.
Well, that year is when I realized control. That it was mine, that I had no help. And so from that point on, I just did it. And the way I have it now, all the performers know what I like or don't like. They know I don't have body songs. They know that it's a family thing. They know that there are certain things that they can or can't do. And they're all very respectful. And so now what I do when I see them coming in the gate, I write their names down. See, as I said, no formality whatsoever. Everything, because I used to schedule this program and people wouldn't show up. See, we don't pay anybody. People just come because they want to. We pay for workshops. That's all. The park gives me enough for that. And I pay for workshops. And I get people that come from a long way off or something to do those to help with their expenses. I don't, you know, it'd be nice to use local people, but I have an ulterior motive, like the Morgans from North Carolina do the guitar thing,
mm-hmm.
and that helps pay their expenses. And the Corn Drinkers, they do all sorts of things for me. So they do the biggest part of the workshops, and that pays them. Now, Eleanor Greenleaf, she does the hammered dulcimer, because there aren't that many hammered dulcimers, but she's from Lawrenceburg. But it's grown into as much as, just about as much as the park can handle, people-wise. I mean, we could use some more in the audience, I don't mean that, but the lodge has already been full. It's been full all. It's filled up 22 rooms. They have 28. They rented 22 the day last day of the festival.
That's what we did. We went up to pay our bill, and as we paid the bill, we made reservations for next year.
Yeah, well,
we got out the calendar to look and see, and it was already marked.
Yeah, right. And the cabins, I think there were, last time I checked, two, three or four, maybe efficiency cabins is all that was left. And so the park's real happy with it, so anything I do is all right with them, you see. But like the program, everybody knows that it's kind of a first-come, first-served thing, ever who comes in. But now after that Friday night, then it's a little more complicated for me as far as scheduling is concerned on Saturday night. I have a lot of problems, you know, with getting those that want to leave early on, or somebody that claims they're too sick about staying the night air. Or I said, if there's some way you can get, see, we have an awful, there's like, I counted just in my head the other day, 65 that performed last year. I mean, that's including the bands and so forth. I mean, just in my head without putting it down. Somebody asked me how many, and I said, well, I figure around 75, and without even writing it down. And, you know, everybody just comes. They come everywhere. There's
Oh, that's part of the fun of this festival.
They plan their vacations
around it. Who is going to come? You know, and like the year that we were there, Liz and Lynn Shaw were there.
Mm-hmm.
We had no idea they were just over across in Ashland. We were in Knoxville. We had no idea they were just over there. After we came up here and met them, well, then we started watching North Carolina, and we ran over there a couple of times when they were doing something here and there, and it kind of proliferates like that.
Well, Nick Holman came 1 year down, he's from South Carolina, came 1 year down at Greenbow. Well, he came year before last, came back last year and brought a couple from down in there, and they're coming back this year. And so that's from South Carolina, and we have several from North Carolina, and there's a lawyer from Massachusetts comes down every once in a while from Boston. He plays old-time banjo. He hadn't been down for a couple of years. There's a couple from Oregon that we met when we were out in Washington. It's been here 3 years in a row. About 2 years ago, we had a couple from Australia that's coming back next year.
So have you ever kept a guest book?
I used to, and then I forgot about it. I should have. Yeah.
It would be fun, because, you know, kind of one of the things about this music is you can be a citizen in the United States and not know anything, you not know that this music even exists.
Yeah, that's true.
If you rely on television and for your main source of information, But once you find out that it's here, it's very rich and available. Mm-hmm. But you've got to get on the right kind of news circuit, or you don't hear what's happening.
We had a couple of girls from France one year, and they came back the next year, and they were such a nuisance to everybody that I failed to send them anything since then. They had their possessions scattered in everybody's room and everybody's car, and they like to worry us to death. I thought, well, they can stay in France as far as I'm concerned.
You kind of control the audience too, don't you? You've got this down to a fine science. I can see what you've done.
One year down at Greenbow, there was a fellow from Australia, found out he played the mandolin, didn't know it at the time. And there was a boy from England and a girl from France. It wasn't the same girl as another one. She sat over under a tree in a Volkswagen seat, and it must have been the year it rained.
The year we were there, we stood under a tarp till it just finally, we were so wet.
Well, she sat there, and we thought she was dead for a while. And I was up around the stage once, and he was playing Cripple Creek or something, and I saw her finger. I said, she's alive. She was there when we quit. And she came down, came out and got her things up, and she said, she sat through every performance, rain or what. We had some shelter on the stage. She said, I just want you to know I've enjoyed this more than anything I've seen in the United States. That she had been to Nashville, and she'd been down Renfro Valley. And she said, this was what I was looking for. But she hadn't said a word to anybody. But she could speak English, but, you know, she just hadn't said, you know, I mean, she'd said a word, but I mean, she hadn't conversed. but anyhow, had the one from Australia, a couple of boys from California, and one from Oregon, and two from Alaska. And then I came across, there was one from Indiana, and came across, and a couple from Pennsylvania. And then the fellow from Boston, and then the boy from England. And I got them all up on the stage and took the picture.
Oh,
and the picture
great.
Didn't come out. It was rainy and dark, and back under that stage, it just, you know, it just wasn't good at all. I needed a photographer. I'm also the photographer.
You're the photographer. You're the mail list. You take care of the mail list. That stage, though, had a nice informal, relaxed mm-hmm. feel to it.
Yeah. Well, I'm so home at Carter Caves. I like it so much better. I hated Greenbow all the time we were there. Oh, I hated it. I wasn't. In fact, that's why we're back at Carter Caves. I decided I was not going to do another festival at all if I had to go down there. And they heard about it out there, and John Turney called and asked if I'd bring it out there, except it would have to be after Labor Day. We had it in August then. It had to be after Labor Day, and I'd bring it out there, and they would help me. At Greenbow, I had to pay them.
Oh,
I had to do the gate. I did the gate.
Can't believe it.
And what I ended up doing with the gate, I did try to get people to do it, and then I decided, well, the thing to do is to give them a percentage of the gate. And that way they'll be sure they collect from everybody. You know, the more you take in, the more you're going to get, you know. So, in fact, one of the couples that worked down there one year on the gate. He is now in Hollywood writing for Johnny Carson.
Is that right?
Bob Smith. You see his name on the credits sometimes. Terry and Bob, yeah.
Huh. That's an interesting connection.
Yeah. So.
We talked to somebody that went to high school with Johnny Carson, and they said he was, as a high school kid, that he was so funny in high school that it was something that he, you know, they described it as that he was gifted with it, and that is what he did, even as a high school person. He's one of the most relaxed
people in the
audience.
Yeah, he is. I don't happen to be a Johnny Carson fan myself, but I don't think he's that funny myself. There's times he is, and sometimes it's the juvenile. So I was that way about Jonathan Winters, too, so.
I do like Johnny Carson's little opening comments.
Yeah,
the first 5 minutes, because he kind of wraps up what is happening, you know, what Reagan is doing, or what President Carter is doing, or he kind of wraps things up, and sometimes I kind of enjoy that.
I think all this started you asking me about how this by coordinating these festivals.
I'm
going to
ask you something else. I'm going to ask you something else.
It's a little roundabout way.
Is that I have seen, and I've been on programs where where they tell us, I want y'all play three tunes, you know, and the purpose of that is to keep new and exciting things happening on stage. I've been where they said we have 30 minutes, and I've been in a situation where they said we had an hour and so forth. And in this Friday night that I've got that has my name as the person who is responsible for it, I had the most awful time trying to figure out, because I don't want to have to... Well, my biggest fear is that I'll have to interrupt somebody, and I don't want to sit and keep time. You know, I don't want it at the stroke of 14 and a half minutes, you're going to be, oh, get away from that microphone.
I went to one in South Carolina like that. They had the clock out there. Well, when that clock went around, you're supposed to be off.
Well, you... At your festival, I didn't see any problems with that. It seems so congenial and...
However...
How do you do that?
Last year, I put a sign up backstage that said, performers, please limit sets to 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. Then
when I came out... It was on the ground, turned upside down, and I took a picture of it. I said, that's what they think of that sign. They try. I told them this year I'm going to limit them three numbers so they won't do the five.
That's what I'm really getting into, but I don't know.
Well, you know, we don't have any time. We don't have any set time. We have to be off. You know, the only thing that I'm trying to get them to cut their time down for is because we have so many people to go on, and by the time some of them get on, it's midnight, and after midnight, and the audience is thinned out, you know, and so then when that happens, I try to get these are on last. I put them on first on Saturday night. I try, if I can remember who it was, And although there's some people that's so nice that, you know, that they'll say, somebody will be wanting to go on, saying, we'll go ahead and let them on, you know, and I'll wait. And they'll end up back where they shouldn't, you know, and so I try to keep that in mind, you know. If they're that nice, well, then they deserve to get up front sometimes. So you have to have a lot of diplomacy. I have learned how to deal with certain ones that used to really bug me to death, that I just dreaded seeing them come. And over the years, I think I've kind of gotten them under control in that they're not telling me how to run everything. Or there was one, I won't mention any names, first year he was there, he was telling me how to do the square dance, and he had somebody in mind that he could come down to. And I said, well, we're doing it the way we like it, you know, this is the way that the dancers like it. And, oh, I really appreciate, you know, your offer to get so-and-so, you know, but, and it would really hurt this fellow's feelings, you know, if we replaced him with somebody. I had to go through, well, he graduated, quit after a year or two. I didn't hear any more about that, and then there were other things, too. And now he comes and does his thing too long, but no problem. So I have managed to put him on near the end just about every time. I'm hoping he'll finally get discouraged. Either I put him on at the end or at the beginning when nobody is there yet. And he has never caught on yet. He's real good. It's just that he is boring. Somebody said, how can anybody be so good and still so boring? He knows he's an English teacher.
Oh my God.
Okay. We'd been out in Springfield, Missouri at college out there and played, and Danielle met a couple of boys from El Paso. And they hitchhiked in one year, got here about Monday or Tuesday, I think. And when we'd been in Washington, we'd met a boy there that decided he wanted to come to the festival. Well, he came by way of Florida and brought some girl that he didn't even know. And so there was four here. From Sunday or Monday, maybe. And then I woke up on Thursday morning, and there was a car out here with one asleep on top of the car and one in the car from North Carolina.
The dog would run Fred up on Fred Coon. He got up on top of the car. He got out of the car. And the dog took out after him. He got up on top of the car and just stayed there the rest of the night. Well, then we came home. I mean, we did the festival. Came home on Sunday night. They all came home with us. By the time Thursday rolled around, and I had cooked, I had cleaned. I mean, I had done the whole festival now and worn out. And I also load up all the equipment, the sound equipment, and unload it all and everything. Of course, now they helped me do that. And Pete helped me with the sound that year. And he took some pictures. But I also fed him. When we go in the market, he would get the things he wanted to eat and put in my basket for me. Well, by the time Thursday came, now this is just one year I'm talking
so
about.
So they've been here Monday, and they've
well, been
here
a week
night.
Before and stayed the
oh,
next
the week.
Week
before, and then they went to the festival with you, and then you came back
and they were
Sunday.
Still here.
And this is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Thursday. So finally I told Pete, I said, you know, Pete, you know, I could understand you're being here, but you know, why is Vivian still here? This girl that nobody, none of us knew in the first place, you know. You know, and I didn't even really like for him being here. And these two girls, boys from El Paso, were still here. So the only solution I came up with, I put them all to stringing beans, slicing cucumbers, doing everything for Cannon. They all left the next day. And I don't know why I wasn't that smart in the beginning.
I love these girls.
Then another time, my cousins came up from Florida earlier. And they were here before and after, plus some more. Can't remember who else. I just remember it was a house full. Then another time on Sunday night after doing the whole festival, Gus Mead and a bunch from Washington came, and I was frying bacon and cooking at 12:30 that night. And I decided this has to stop. So now I go to the lodge on Thursday night, and I stay till Monday. I had to.
Kind of takes care of that, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
They can't follow
no, nobody's
you
going to come home and cook for themselves.
No.
And JP didn't even come out on Sunday this year. and it burns, now, maybe it burns me up when I read an article about JP Fraley's festival.
Well, I'd say he's got this arranged perfectly. It all comes off, and then he gets the credit for it.
That's right. In fact, we were supposed to go up to Charleston. You know, you were coming over on Monday,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to play in Charleston on Friday night. Well, you know, my uncle died Friday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So JP called and told him that, you know, we wouldn't be there, you know, because of that. And we hadn't gotten the newsletter yet, and after we got it, I said, well, I'm sure glad we didn't go. My name was spelled A-N-A-D-I-N-E, and it just mentioned that I played the guitar, and it said something nice, I don't remember what. But then it went on to say that J.P. was well known for promoting the Mountain Heritage Festival and the Fraley Family Festival.
Well, it reminds
so
me
of I said, well, I'm glad we didn't go. You know, I wouldn't even mind if he said J.P. and Anna Dean or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at
mm-hmm.
least I should have been in there so they could do it.
You do spell it D-E-E-N-E,
yeah.
Don't you? And it
yeah.
is one word.
Actually, the spelling of the name didn't bother me near as much as the, because it's been spelled every way. We was up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania once and saw this big poster. It said J.P. and A-R-M-O-D-I-N-E Fraley. Armadine.
I like that. They were
so
making you a little more authentically mountain name than you really wanted to be.
So that's become kind of a joke with us. It doesn't matter whether they spell my name right to me now, you know. But it does bother me if they don't give me credit for the festival, since I work so hard at it and he doesn't even turn his hand at
it. Well, you work so hard. And it's something that really people expect you to do. I don't think you can give it up. I mean, I don't think you can say, well, I don't think I'll have one this year. I don't
well,
think
I
you
do
can
every
do
year.
That.
Every year I say I'm not going to do another one.
Oh, well, you always
that's
do that.
That's tradition.
That's part of the way we work.
Part of the friendly
oh, I
tradition.
See. I say I'm not going to do it. And